Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. The Matsu Health Foundation is interested in trying to improve health outcomes. And as part of this effort, they're trying to better understand, in particular, things like behavioral health. In this program, we're going to discuss the what's called the who, what, and where, or in medical terms, the epidemiology of behavioral health. The systems for addressing these problems that exist and suggestions for improvement. This is all going to be done under the findings of a Matsu Behavioral Health Environmental Scan that the foundation has done. Joining us today in the studio are Dr. Melissa Kimberling. She's Director of Programs for the Matsu Health Foundation, and Ray Michelson. He's a program officer for the what's called the Healthy Minds Focus Area, also for the Matsu Health Foundation. Welcome to both of you.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Nice to have you guys here. Let me let my listeners know real quickly, as usual, you can reach us during the next 58 minutes plus here. If you need to, with questions or comments, experiences, anything you'd like to share. In Anchorage, you can call us directly at 550-8433, 550-8433. If you're listening throughout the state or a few people will listen out of state, we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And we also have our usual email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Please spell it out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, line1@alaskapublic.org. So let's start by asking one of you guys to tell us a little bit about the history and funding and goals of the Matsu Health Foundation.
Okay. Well, the Matsu Health Foundation was formed about 10 years ago when a for-profit company bought out the Valley Hospital, which was a community hospital. And one of the conditions was to form this health foundation. And so we consider ourselves a joint venture with Matsu Regional Medical Center. We seat half of the governing board, and we also get a portion of their profits to reinvest in our community. We give out approximately $7 million to help promote health in our community each year.
I had no idea that was the operating mechanism here. That's, to me, fairly unique. Maybe other hospitals do that, but if they do, I'm not aware of it. So why did that come to be? Who bought it out? Who started the idea, do you know?
Well, I believe the first company that bought us out was TRICARE. Uh-huh. And basically, we wanted to make sure that the needs of the community were represented. Uh-huh. And also, it was an issue as far as having to build the hospital and uh-huh. to get equity. We uh-huh. needed a for-profit partner to do that.
Uh-huh. And so $7 million a year comes into the foundation, partly in income coming from the hospital, and then other ways you get that kind of money?
No, pretty much just from the hospital. That supports the uh-huh. Infrastructure of the foundation uh-huh. as well. We're also able to give grants out into the community.
Uh-huh. So if I were to say, what's a mission or goals, what would you say to that question?
So our mission is to improve the health and wellness of Alaskans living in Matsu.
Okay. How about the programs that you have? Is there more than a couple of different kinds of programs you're doing?
Well, we respond. We do responsive grant making. So, you know, when there's a group in Matsu that has a need that's related to health, we can fund those kind of grants. But more recently, we've moved to a more strategic grant making. So we have three focus areas. One is Healthy Minds, which is looking at the behavioral health treatment system. We have Healthy Aging, which is looking at the system that serves seniors to be as independent and healthy as possible throughout their lives. And then we also have a Healthy Foundations for Families, which is supporting families and preventing child maltreatment.
So those are three separate areas that you're putting grants out focused on those kinds of things.
Right. And our program officers also do a lot other than just give out grants. They help support coalitions in our community. If we have a lot of organizations that come to us for the same sort of issue, we'll bring together, we'll convene those organizations so that they're all talking to each other and working together. Mm-hmm. But then we also have a whole arm which works on policy at the state level,
right.
and our executive
right.
director, and we have a director of public affairs who are really involved in that. So we take a systems approach. So we try and not just fund individual organizations. We try and kind of have a bird's eye view over how a whole system works and mm-hmm. figure out where are the gaps, who's not working together, what has to happen at the policy level to make things better for the people providing services on the ground.
Yeah, as I understand the scan, that was the purpose of the scan, basically what you just said.
Right.
Okay.
I think also, if I could just chime in, sure. that I think the behavioral health scan has really helped us to go beyond responsive grant making through working in those focus areas, but it's really given us an edge, if you will, to kind of get out past the grant making to really work strategically to improve the system of healthcare in the Valley, kind of in response to some of the findings of the report that we'll talk about in a little bit.
I would guess, and again, I have been involved with nonprofits in the past, and so often the nonprofit may be focused on some particular area, whereas what I hear from what you're saying is you really went out and tried to understand a big problem in a much deeper way, and then that helps you address the problems with a better understanding. You got what's the problem, what's the numbers, and who's doing the care, and what are the rate limiting kinds of problems that you're getting into, and then you got the policy. If you're going to change things, somebody's got to be out there trying to explain to everybody else what's going on.
Right. And where this all came about was as we're actually considered a nonprofit hospital in the eyes of the IRS. And mm-hmm. because of that, we have to do a community health needs assessment every 3 years. Mm-hmm. And we did a community health needs assessment. And the top five issues in our community, we did 23 community meetings with over 500 individuals. And the top five issues were all related to behavioral health. So this really started us on that road to having these focus areas and doing the behavioral health scan.
Did that surprise you?
It did a little bit. We thought obesity would come up or cancer, but no. So number one was alcohol and substance abuse. Number two was child and youth abuse and violence. Number three, tied for third place, was access to mental health care, depression and suicide, and domestic violence and sexual assault. So we actually were quite surprised that it was so overwhelmingly focused on behavioral health.
Yeah, and I think also that some of those results, too, were just kind of confirmed, I think, some anecdotal things that you've been hearing, I think, in the community with regard to access to treatment or the number of treatment or intervention programs that might have been present. So I think it really helped to kind of confirm what people were understanding, were the conditions in MATSU relative to that.
It really makes sense to me. As any primary care provider, if you really pin them down, they're going to tell you that mental health, psychosocial health are huge components of day-to-day practice. A number that I've quoted a number of times before, there was a physician named Balfour who was the outpatient director of health at Stanford University until he died. And for 40 years, his research was basically, why do people come to outpatient medical clinics at Stanford University? And the short answer is one-third had purely health problems. They broke a leg. They had inflammatory bowel disease. Another third of them had no medical problem whatsoever. It was all psychosocial mental health. And the other third had medical problems, but the reason they were in the system was the psychosocial mental health anxiety issue. So that in our healthcare system, in primary care, I think most primary care physicians would tell you that a huge percentage of everything we do every day has a psychosocial, mental health, behavioral health background. So to me, it's nice to see that the community is aware of that. I'm not sure most people involved in healthcare are even aware of that.
We did 65 interviews with professionals and different mm-hmm. groups in the community. And in fact, the group that brought this up to us when we were doing the community health needs assessment were school nurses. We gave them a list of 10 health issues that we had identified looking at the data for Matsu, but they said you have to put on that list that we're voting for as far as the health issues that are, you know, the highest priority. You have to put on access to mental health care because we see kids all the time and we can't get them into services. So that, you know, and then we talked to ministers in the churches and they said we don't have any place to refer kids to for substance abuse treatment. Or I mean, it just came up with all the different sectors that we were talking to, not just medical.
Yeah, but particularly access.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Particularly access.
All right. Well, let's do this. Let's define behavioral health. And since we're going to talk about a behavioral health scan, how do you define behavioral health as part of this evaluation?
Basically, it's pretty simple. We define it as anything related to mental health or substance abuse.
Okay. I was going to nitpick you a little bit into when you said obesity is not on there. Most of even the ACEs study originated in people who were obese, mm-hmm. trying to figure out why they were obese, and mental health issues were a huge part of that. But I won't go there.
No, I agree with you. I feel like that underlying so many physical ailments can be related to mental health or behavioral health issues.
All right. Before we talk about the scan, why don't we talk about, Ray, what you're doing, what's your aspect, what area that you're involved in particularly then?
Well, I was pretty fortunate coming on to the Health Foundation just short of a year ago, actually, after quite a few years in the Division of Juvenile Justice working with at-risk youth and different kinds of behavioral health programming that we would provide in those correctional detention facilities. So I came on at a really good time because the behavioral health scan results were pretty fresh and hot off the press at the time that I joined. So my particular focus area of Healthy Minds really surrounds the behavioral health treatment system, which would include also access to emergency treatment and emergency interventions as well. So as you can see, then it also gets into the high utilizer population and then a whole host of things that are going on in our community that are related to behavioral health. So my particular focus area then, as we kind of talked about earlier, really gets away from and past the grant making and into really the community kind of organizing and really trying to develop strategies to not just address the recommendations of the report necessarily, but really to address what the needs of our service delivery system currently is in Matsu.
Let me take one second before we ask you, one of you, to talk about the scan in particular, to let listeners know that you're listening to Line 1, your health connection, originating in Anchorage, Alaska, at Alaska Public Media. Today's guests are Melissa Kimberling, she's Director of Programs, and Ray Michelson, who is the Program Officer for the Healthy Minds Focus, both for the Matsu Health Foundation. And what we're discussing today is an environmental scan on behavioral health that the Matsu Foundation has done, and we want to know about the results and consequences of that evaluation. If you've got questions or comments, there's a couple of ways you can get a hold of us over the next 45 minutes or so. We are in Anchorage, and our local number is 550-8433. Our email address is line1, and you have to spell that out, all one word, LINEONE, line1@alaskapublic.org. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. All right, so tell us about the environmental health scan.
Okay. Well, it's composed of three different reports. The first one, which was completed in September of last year, focuses on the emergency system for behavioral health. And we looked, one of the main parts of that is looking at who shows up in the emergency room at Matsu Regional Medical Center for behavioral health crises. And then we also looked at this whole system, and we compared all the services we have in Matsu with an ideal system of care from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. So we were able to identify the different gaps we have in services. And we also looked at what funding the state provides and third-party reimbursers like Medicaid or private insurance provides for these types of services. and how they relate to the gaps we have in the system. And then we also looked at the state policy that pertains to who can provide behavioral health services, all the things that also help to shape that system on the ground. Right now, we're also finishing up the third report, which is focused on prevention, so helping to prevent behavioral health problems in the first place. And we're really looking at the adverse childhood experiences theory to inform that report and to figure out how to prevent child maltreatment in MATSU.
All right, well, we definitely want to talk about what the adverse childhood experiences issue is that you brought up. It's we've talked about it a couple of times on the program before, but it is such an important way of thinking about behavioral health that I want to make sure we talk about that. But let's go back to the beginning and tell us what you found about your emergency services, what kinds of problems they were addressing. Sure. As a start, I guess.
Sure. So we found out, so we looked at 1 year, 2013, and we found out that the emergency department sees close to 2,400 patients with behavioral health diagnoses. And that costs, and this is a low estimate because it doesn't include the separate physician charges. This is just the hospital charges. It totaled about $23 million. And what was really interesting was where some of those patients came back over and over again, and they had very, very high charges. So we had about 300 high utilizers that had five or more visits in 1 year, and then we had about 99 who had 10 or more visits and 19 who had 15 or more visits. So it was obvious to us that these people were not getting their needs met in the larger system and the outpatient care in the MATSU, and that they just kept showing up. And in fact, what was interesting was we don't have a behavioral health emergency department. They were just seeing regular doctors. So they weren't getting specialized behavioral health care when they showed up there. They were just having very high charges and then having to be referred to somewhere else, and then they were coming back again. So it made us realize something was broken with the system.
How did that compare with, you said you could compare that with the ideal mental health system?
Well, part of the ideal mental health system would be to have some sort of specialized care for crises, but mm-hmm. also to have care for people before they get into crises. So like in Anchorage, there's the crisis respite center. Mm-hmm. So people can go in there when they're starting to feel like mm-hmm. they are going to have a crisis, if they're on, maybe get their meds adjusted or just, you know, be able to get the support they need so they don't end up at the emergency department. So we basically don't have a behavioral health crisis infrastructure in MATSU. We're expected to use this system in Anchorage, but transportation is such an issue for people in MATSU to get into Anchorage to get that care.
And the scan just involved the MATSU Valley?
Yes, but we always compare ourselves to the whole state of Alaska. And we looked at policy and funding. We had to look at, you know, statewide mm-hmm. funding.
Mm-hmm. All right. So you found out that a lot of people, a fairly high percentage of people, go to the emergency room for mental health or behavioral health problems, and that there was a smaller group that were there a lot. Why were they there a lot?
They, as the emergency physicians told us, they're very complex
right.
patients. They have a right. lot of complex needs. In fact, when we defined the behavioral health patient, they had to have just gone there one time with a behavioral health diagnosis, but oftentimes they went there with the primary complaint as another physical diagnosis. Usually, you know, the national research shows that a lot of times these high utilizers are seniors or behavioral health, patients or people with chronic medical diseases. Mm-hmm. And that's consistent in MATSU.
How about having a primary care provider that they could turn to? Was that an issue that came up at some point or not?
That is something that they need. I mean, mm-hmm. when we think about managing these high utilizers, the response that's been used in the rest of the nation is to have a case manager mm-hmm. and link them with a medical home. Mm-hmm. And we don't have the data to know whether what the percentage of these people do have a primary care provider, but that is the strategy that we want to use to get them care. It's
So I know Providence has a mental health approach to emergency room visits. Do you know what percentage of hospitals in the United States or some gestalt about how well the United States as an organ, as a country responds to emergency room and these urgent cares? And I'm also always interested how we compare with the rest of the developed world. Do you have that kind of information, or you didn't go that far?
We didn't go that far.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to guess that many of the large, particularly maybe university-oriented hospitals or related hospitals do have some mental health facilities within the emergency room. But really, if we look at all the hospitals, it's probably only a minority that's doing this.
I think you have to have a large enough population to be able to pay for that kind of infrastructure.
Well, yeah. I mean, are we paying for it one way or the other, the issue? So you said $23 million was the hospital charges. Do you know how that relates to the rest of the charges in the emergency room? Is there some way to, you know, is that one-third of what happens in there? We don't know that.
That's a good question, and I don't remember that statistic off the top of my head.
Yeah. So if my numbers were right from Dr. Balfour's research, it might be as much as a half or even more of the total health, depending on how you look at people with physical needs and really get into why they're there. I couldn't afford my medication. Mm-hmm. Well, you have a health care need, but your problem is it's like a social one, or I don't, you know, there's various and sundry. Depression and anxiety drives a lot of health care problems that are physical problems or appear to be physical problems. Yeah.
And the other thing is that we have an incomplete behavioral health system. So, you know, we have very few detox beds. So when a physician in the emergency department has someone who is detoxing or wants to get off substances or alcohol, they don't have any place to send them. So having an incomplete system results in people winding up in the emergency department over and over again.
Yeah. So part of the problem is, if I can expand on what you just said, of the frequent users, is the system is not set up to address their needs.
Right.
I hear you right.
Yep.
I mean, we blame them, but the fact is we're not giving them the opportunities to resolve the problems they have.
Correct. And also, if you look, the other problem that we found with the system is that people are not getting their needs addressed early. So the funding that is put out by the state of Alaska and by a lot of third-party reimbursers is for kids with serious emotional disturbance or adults with serious mental illness or people that with a diagnosed substance use disorder. But it's very hard for people to get services and get in to see people if they just have mild to moderate symptoms. So then that makes the symptoms get worse and their condition get worse, and then they can finally get care when they're serious, have serious problems. So that's another problem with the whole system.
So I think it's that, if I can just chime in a little bit, I think that's, you know, part of the reason that the high utilizer population can be kind of a chronic condition, because they've kind of been brought up with kind of the idea that you're only sick when you're really, really sick, and you only need assistance or attention when you're really, really sick, instead of doing kind of that interim kind of maintenance or care or attention or even some intervention early on.
Okay. Was the scan modeled after some other effort to do the same thing, or was this something you guys kind of figured out on your own?
It was something we figured out on our own. That's the one thing that we feel like we're in a really special place, being the foundation, because everybody else that's working in the system is really busy seeing people and doing what they need to be doing. But we can take a bird's eye view of everything and try and have a real systems approach. And when I designed this, we put this out to bid and we had consultants work on it, but I couldn't find anything similar that really had this systems approach. So we kind of cobbled together a lot of different ways to do this research to create this scan.
All right. Well, I definitely want to come back and hear more about what you said, but we're already, hard to believe, 30 minutes into this program. So I want to take our mid-break. We have one listener holding and one email, so I want to make sure they don't leave us, but we have to take a very short break. I want to remind listeners, if you're listening to Line 1, your health connection, our local number again, 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We'll be off the air for just about 1 minute, and then we'll continue our discussion of the MATSU Behavioral Health Environmental Scan with Dr. Melissa Kimberling and Ray Michelson of the MATSU Health Foundation. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today on Line 1 are Dr. Melissa Kimberling. She is Director of Programs for the MATSU Health Foundation, and also from the foundation is Ray Michelson. He is a program officer for the Healthy Minds focus area. If you've got questions or comments, there's a couple of ways you can get in touch with us over the next 30 minutes or so. And that's by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433. And our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening to the program between, I think it's 7 and 8, I may have... I'm hopefully 7 or 8 or 8 or 9. I think we've changed the time on that, and I may not have changed it on my notes. But on Monday evening, if you're listening, you're listening to a rebroadcast, and that's a taped recording. We will not be available to answer your questions. So if you've got questions or comments, why don't you give us a call or drop us an email right now? Let's go ahead and take a phone call. I see that we have one holding. Anna, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I'm a social work major at UAA and a Valley resident, and I just wanted to share my experience. I recently did ACE training through my son's daycare. I wasn't sure what it was about, and it actually was very traumatizing to me. I had a 9 out of 10 on the ACE score, and I've been in treatment for 3 years with a psychologist, and I think I would be a lot worse off if I had not had someone to go to and talk to. It was, I think there needs to be, people are going to do this kind of training, I think it's definitely helpful, but there needs to be some kind of a follow-up in place for people that, to talk to and work out through some of this stuff that's brought up.
We will take your lead and jump right in. We're going a little bit ahead of the scheme, but ACE is such an important instrument and predictor of health, and I'm sure our guests can help us understand that a little bit better. So we'll move ahead and talk about ACEs for you and see what they're doing to help address the problem of high ACE scores to keep having some problems down the line, as I hear you asking.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for your call, Anna.
Thank you.
All right. What in the world are we talking about when we say ACEs?
Okay. ACEs stands for Adverse Childhood Experiences, and it was coined after a research study done about 15 years ago by Dr. Andes and Dr. Folletti out of Kaiser Permanente. And basically they asked their patients, they did this study asking about 17,000 patients that use Kaiser Permanente about their experiences in childhood. And they were trying to assess how many people had adverse childhood experiences. So that could be physical, verbal, emotional abuse, or family dysfunction, which could be, or household dysfunction, which could be a parent using substance abuse, or a parent who's, or guardian who's incarcerated, someone in the household who's depressed or is committed or tried to commit suicide. There are about 10 of these adverse childhood experiences. And even since then, there's been others as far as historical trauma and discrimination or bullying in schools, just basically anything that causes trauma and stress in, on a continuous basis for children. And what they found is that the more adverse childhood experiences that one has, it's linked to health problems later on in life. So, and also risk more health risk behaviors like smoking and drinking and also being depressed or attempting suicide or having cancer or being obese. There's a number of different conditions as an adult that they are seeing really correlate with having these adverse childhood experiences. So there has been an effort to educate people about this. The flip side of that is, though, that that should also be stressed with these trainings, which I'm not sure if it wasn't the one that this caller had mentioned, is that there's there are ways that you can decrease or kind of moderate the effect of these adverse childhood experiences, and that is by having support for the children and for the adults. A lot of times they call this resilience. They're trying to support these individuals to build hope, have them connected to other people in the community, have them feel confident and capable. So that's something that has to go along with that type of training. The ACEs study focused a lot on how this trauma affects people's brains. That's actually the research that came after that first big study. And so in children, what it causes children to be in a fight or flight response on a very prolonged period. So they have a hard time in school because they are in this fight and flight mental status. But there are definitely things we can do in our schools to help. I mean, of course, the first thing is you want to prevent ACEs mm-hmm. from happening at all. And then when they have happened, you want to create an environment where that individual and the parent feel supportive. And it sound, and just like this caller was saying that they have been in counseling and they've been getting the support they need. And that's wonderful and crucial. And she can help parent her child in a way that is very supportive as well.
So there's got to be listeners out there. I mean, people, the way humans think, if we don't understand it, if we don't have a good understanding, our first thought is, I don't know if I buy this. So how are you going to convince somebody that early childhood experiences have lifelong effects?
Well, if you were an epidemiologist and you saw all the graphs from this data, you would it's the exact graph you would want for any epidemiological study, that the more ACEs you have, the more likely you are to have
these. The more adverse experiences early in life, the more it correlates, not necessarily cause-effect, but this is pretty consistently over and over and over again.
Right. And it's so that's very strong epidemiological data, but then since then they've been able to show the what's happening to the brain.
So mechanisms to explain the outcomes.
Exactly.
Well, so we talked a day or so ago, and I'm going to tell you how I tell patients what's happening, and I don't remember where I heard this or where I jumped to this, but it will help listeners understand, and that is that what we know about the human brain is that it is an extremely good learner. Kids learn dramatically, rapidly. Your brain is growing faster because of stimulation of various signs, hearing, vision, what they see people interact, how they learn to talk. Everything's happening. It's faster in the first several 3 years of life than it's ever going to happen again. And it's very good at learning. But what the human brain is not good at is unlearning. And once you start rethinking about that, it becomes a lot more obvious, I think. And what I mean is you can't tell me how to unlearn how to ride a bike. You can't tell me how to unlearn how to read or unlearn how to talk. And so what gets ingrained in a sense, in a true physical hardwiring sense, is if kids are seeing a lot of emotional trauma very early in life, that changes their brains compared to other kids who are not experiencing that. And they act differently because of it for a long time. And it doesn't mean it's permanent, but it means it's harder to change. And that's where we're getting it. Therapy is helpful, but prevention is better. And so what were your ACEs findings when you started looking at patients or people who came to the emergency room? Did you find that they had a significant amount of ACEs?
We didn't do that.
Oh, you didn't
study.
Look at that. Okay.
No.
I, for some reason, I thought when I was looking through it that it was present. Most people are surprised when we look at ACEs data is how high those numbers are.
Yeah.
So it's much another issue that I would think is important for people to hear is that there's a lot of those going on within houses that have not been talked about, and people begin to understand why they may have the anxieties they have or the problems they have interacting with other people or their desires to do something to make them feel better and so forth. Was not necessarily genetic, but it was based on some early priming, so to speak, of how their behavior. And that's been shown over and over. Now we have mechanisms that document that.
Right. In fact, we do have some results on ACEs in MATSU. They do a statewide survey called
right.
the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance right. System. And I believe 33% of our residents have zero ACEs.
Okay.
So
that strikes me as high, but maybe I'm wrong. So they have very little. Okay.
Right. Yeah. So that means that, you know, close to 70% have had at least one ACE.
Right.
So
right.
it's just common. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. That's why you want to create a whole community that is focused on supporting people who have had ACEs and also preventing ACEs. And so that brings me to, we have an initiative at the MATSU Health Foundation called Rock MATSU. It's called Raising Our Kids with Kindness, and that stands for ROCK. And the focus is increasing family resiliency and strengthening a culture in our community that supports children and families, and also reducing child maltreatment and the number of MATSU children experiencing ACEs.
Okay. We still have an email I want to get back to, but Ray, I want to ask you, came through the I'm blocking on the right term, jail system, but incarceration of kids, I think, right?
Yes.
So when did you become aware of the ACEs data? Did it take getting hooked up with the MATSU Foundation, or were you aware of that beforehand? And does it make sense to you? Does it help you understand things better?
I was fairly well educated in the ACEs study and trauma-informed care systems, not only in schools but also in juvenile correctional and detention facilities. And the Division of Juvenile Justice at the time, just a couple of years ago, had started an initiative to try to convert our jail systems and correctional systems into more of a trauma-informed approach to really start to understand the impact of ACEs on current behavior,
right?
Whether it be behavioral health type issues or criminality and things like that. So, I arrived at the foundation with a fairly good basis of understanding of how important that really is. And you had mentioned earlier about the kind of the rapid process of learning in the 0 to 3, 0 to 5. So you can kind of see how important it is really for school systems to really understand ACEs and to understand children and their resiliency and the effect of some of those experiences as it impedes the learning environment in a particular classroom. And I think the caller, her example was linked to a school, as I recall. So it's really important for those kinds of systems to become more trauma-informed and more understanding of what kids bring into the classroom really every day with regard to their ACEs. So,
I don't think, and maybe I hope I'm wrong, I don't think the general public really understands the understanding and options for remediating problems with kids that the ACEs construct allows us to use. And it's nice to see that not only in our healthcare system, but in the educational system, in our penal system, and our court system, it's very rapidly has gained acceptance. It's really surprising, and yet I don't know that the general public is as aware of it as perhaps it would be nice to say.
You know, I think there's been an increased awareness, I think, in some of our kind of more institutional systems, education and corrections for both juvenile and adult, about really trying to focus in on kind of what contributes to the behavior, knowing that we want kids to emerge from the school system just having taken in all of what they can get, you know, from a school system, and to be able to kind of the school system kind of mitigating those things that impede learning. But even in the correctional environments, we want returning citizens and returning juveniles to go back home after a period of incarceration with that much more skill to be able to stay away from criminal behavior, which means really getting back to some of that ACEs data. And I think that even the Department of Health and Social Services is trying to construct a screening tool for kids and even adults that helps their caregivers to learn more about what their experiences have been, so they can tailor some of those programs to what those needs are.
Let me remind listeners once again, it's Line 1, your health connection. Today we're talking about the MATSU and behavioral health scan, environmental scan. If you've got questions or comments about what you hear, our local number 550-8433, 550-8433, email address line1@alaskapublic.org, and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. So I got an email that says, we know there's a huge lack of services where people can detox or seek concurrent mental health treatment in Anchorage and MATSU. What needs to happen to turn that around? Do we need more facilities and personnel dedicated to this mental health crisis?
Well, yes, yes, and yes, I suppose. The short answer is, it's our understanding there really are a very small number of detox beds in the Anchorage MATSU region, and those particular beds are located right here in the Anchorage area. MATSU is reliant upon detox services here in Anchorage to service the needs of residents out in the MATSU. So with our growing population, as you can imagine, with some of the heroin addiction and increased use of painkillers and so on, and the increasing number of overdoses, that there are people that are coming to the emergency department that are in need of detoxification services. They are long past prevention, long past early intervention, and are really at a really, really crucial point where they, if we had the services, that we could then put them right in those kinds of beds. So we do lack those particular services right now. There are a few things that are kind of in the works right now with regard to potential funding of substance abuse services along a continuum of services, which would include detox beds, potentially form the MATSU area. Things are fast moving in the legislature right now with regard to funding, and we're hoping to come out on top with regard to taking advantage of a potential opportunity to be part of creating those kinds of services.
Should we or can we talk about barriers to? I mean, we just got through talking about a couple of barriers, and we've talked about some preventative things. Just to put, as I see it, some perspective on the phone call and the ACEs and the question from the email. But what are? Let's quantify some of the barriers a little bit more.
When I think of barriers, I think of two things. One, barriers to an individual getting into behavioral health care. So what we found in our scan was that we have services out there, not enough of them. But even the services that we have, most of the people that we interviewed, there was a said that people just don't know about them, that there's no one central place that keeps a resource list updated and helps people find the services that we need. So that's a big finding. Also, you know, affordability is an issue. I think that the Medicaid expansion is going to help a whole group of people get behavioral health services who were not able to get that before. Transportation is an issue, especially when you're dealing with someone who had a DUI and had their license taken away. So for them to get to substance abuse treatment is an issue. And also stigma. That also came up as a big issue, that people don't want other people to know that they're accessing the system for behavioral health care. But then also there's other barriers for the whole system. So I think the email mentioned workforce. So we don't have enough behavioral health providers. In fact, for early childhood, for that 0 to 3 year region, we have one in MATSU who's certified to see kids that young. We don't have enough psychiatrists. A lot of the behavioral health organizations have to use telemedicine to access psychiatry because we don't have enough psychiatrists or psychiatric providers up in MATSU. And also just what gets paid for. So we looked at this whole system and everything that is a gap, like community support services or recovery supports for mental illness or mild to moderate outpatient care, those are the big gaps because nobody pays for that. The grants don't go to those services from the state, and also third-party reimbursers don't always pay for that those kinds of services. And one of the major findings, which is a barrier, is that there's no one entity that kind of looks over the whole system to do this sort of an assessment and make sure the funds go to create a full system of care. There's the Division of Behavioral Health isn't doing that. There's no one entity. So we need some sort of a regional planning system that can help distribute the funds and make sure the care is going to, you know, all the needed types of services and all the people that need those services.
All right. Well, I want to come back to that in just a second, but I'm sitting here while I'm listening to you thinking about response to an email that came in. I want to make sure I'm answering all our emails, but I think I'm going to be the one that has to answer this one, but you guys let me know if you want to answer it. It says, Alaska suffers from one of the most severe environments for the immune system health. Vitamin D deficiency from sunlight deprivation is associated with winter darkness, as well as suffering from the highest rates of alcoholism, chlamydia, gonorrhea, HPV, and herpes simplex virus. Considering the recent links of chlamydia and herpes to mental health issues like Alzheimer's, is there any focus on the viral mental health symptoms that contribute to sexual domestic violence in the form of disease transmission? Why are there not any sharper focuses on encouraging immune health, safe sex, and vaccination on mental health issues? So I'm going to address this one. There's a lot of issues here. And I would agree that vitamin D deficiency is important. It is an immune modulator. However, it's always a question of the chicken or the egg. And these rates of gonorrhea, HPV, herpes, so forth, that's being considered by the author of the email is true everywhere. It's not just in Alaska. It's not just where there's vitamin D deficiency. And although I can't quote the studies, vitamin D deficiency alone has certainly never been shown to be a causal factor in these issues. So, and then we can certainly find plenty of evidence that transmission of sexually transmitted diseases increases when there are mental health problems associated, particularly substance abuse. So, to answer the listener, I think it, my understanding of the questions he's asking is that we do have some vitamin D deficiency. Our immune health here is as good as is anywhere, and I don't think the link to sexually transmitted diseases and mental health issues is the link that he is expounding on here. But I do thank you for the email. So where is this all taking us? What I see is it's one thing to gather data, it's another thing to understand the problem. Change is not easy. As I've said earlier, as humans, you give us the facts. That doesn't necessarily make us change our behaviors ourselves. And yet, what I think it seems like where you're going is, and you've already said, you've got a policy arm. So policy to means trying to change the way things are being done already.
I'll start, but I think Ray has a lot to add on this. As far as the policy work that we've been doing, you know, we thought it was crucial that Medicaid be expanded, and that was something that we tried to provide this data to inform that decision. But also the Medicaid reform that has been going on, there were definitely findings in our report that would, if you changed Medicaid a little bit, it could really expand access for people, say if you increase the number of providers that it could accept Medicaid and so forth. So we tried to bring our findings to inform that process. But Ray has a lot of information about what's been happening on the ground with the results of this scan.
And I know that when I joined the Health Foundation about a year ago, that the crisis intervention team in the Mat-Su area had been kind of in its early planning stages. And I know that most first responders in the form of two police departments, the state troopers, the emergency department at the hospital, borough EMS and fire, they probably didn't need to have a behavioral health scan and data to tell them that there has to be a better way to intervene and really connect people with services between those frequent hospital visits. So they have organized through, you know, the leadership of Captain Brinke at the B Detachment at the Alaska State Troopers in Palmer, and also leadership at the Mat-Su Regional Hospital with Dr. Zink and probably a whole host of other people who really took it upon themselves to explore the crisis intervention team format and are pursuing a kind of a formal chapter, if you will, in the Mat-Su area. I believe that the Anchorage First Responder Group has a CIT, or crisis intervention team, and I believe Fairbanks does as well. But in the interim, before even the final CIT is kind of formed, there are some things very much on the ground that have been have used really the data in the first report to really address the training needs of first responders when they respond to instances of people calling 911 for primarily a behavioral health intervention need. And we have been able to work with first responders in helping to fund some on-the-ground person-to-person training in the form of mental health first aid for law enforcement officials. And that has helped them to be able to better intervene and interact with those suffering from those conditions. Largely, those people would end up either in jail for on some kind of a charge or in the emergency department itself. Kind of a subcommittee work with that crisis intervention team has been that of coordinated care. And I happen to be on that particular subgroup and working with a group of people that are really trying to connect these frequent utilizers of the hospital emergency department with available treatments and between those hospital visits to really try to lessen the frequency of those. But it really all is a matter of kind of recognizing that the high utilizer group is not really getting connected consistently with care between those hospital visits, and that's really where our focus has been. So the CIT, the people in the CIT right now are scheduled to go to an actual training in May to then create policies and procedures for a field team, which would include behavioral health, emergency response, fire, and police to better kind of triage those particular instances and better connect them with services.
Melissa, I'm going to let you end the program with just what you want listeners to remember. We've got just about 30 seconds. It's moved much faster. I know there's a lot more information you'd like to have gotten across, but what do you want listeners to remember from the program?
Well, I think one of the major findings of our scan is that behavioral health issues affect pretty much everybody, whether it's something you have yourself or somebody in your family. And I think that you know, trying to work together to create a system where everybody can get the services and support they need, but also just in general to have a community that's supportive of children and families to prevent these behavioral health issues in the first place.
Well, listen, this has been a fast hour, one of the fastest I've experienced. They keep getting faster, I guess, because I'm so interested. Thanks very much for taking the time, Dr. Melissa Kimberling and Ray Michelson of the Mattsu Health Foundation. If you want to continue this discussion, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at our website, alaskapublic.org. Next week, what are the risks for breast cancer? When do they begin? What are the environmental risks for breast cancer? When do they begin, and what can we do about those things? Next week, we're going to have Dr. Ted Shettler. He's really one of the world's experts on environmental risks for health. He'll be on line one, joining us by telephone on Monday, April 18th. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Eric Bork was our audio engineer and web editor today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.